Hello and welcome to the Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to resume with Revelo Oliver in America's Decline, The Education of a Conservative, and we're up to his Part 6, Aftermath. This will be the second to last. And he has this aftermath, and then he has a whole list of all the things that he wrote for three decades. But I looked at that. I don't think it makes sense to read them off. You wouldn't get too much from that. But if you want that, get the book, if you can find it. And there are PDFs of it floating around. Anyway, so this won't be too awful long. This is maybe 12 pages of an ordinary published hardback type. Part 6, Aftermath. With the July-August issue of 1966, my connection with American opinion came to an end. One, so there's also a few notes. American Opinion, again, the John Birch Society publication that he had a large hand in. So July-August 1966, his connection with American opinion came to an end. I think that is the point at which to conclude this series of selections. The cycle begun in 1954 was completed in 1966, and I had leisure to look back on 12 years of wasted effort and of exertion for which I would never again have either the stamina or the will. And let me throw in that you don't know at what point your body or your mind might go, and when you have the ability to do something and it seems or you think definitely that it is very important, well, friend, you want to do it then. Trust me. After the conference between Welch and myself in November 1965, I determined to verify conclusively the inferences that his conduct had so clearly suggested, and with the assistance of certain friends of long standing who had facilities that I lacked, I embarked on a difficult, delicate, and prolonged investigation. I was trying to find why this guy he thought was kind of a hero and had talked him into joining the cause now seems like he's controlled by third parties lurking in the background somewhere. So in the mid-60s, as he's starting to depart, he starts looking into this as kind of his last act. I was not astonished, although was pained, by the discovery that Welch was merely the nominal head of the Birch business, which he operated under the supervision of a committee of Jews. While Jews also controlled the flow through various bank accounts of the funds that were needed to supplement the money that was extracted from the society's members by artfully passionate exhortations to fight the communists, but never name the Jew, which we heard about in earlier sessions. And again, both George Lincoln Rockwell and William Pierce went through the JBS, however briefly, and were essentially kicked out, not even as members, but just from meetings, for mentioning that communism is Jewish in its conception, its execution, its initial takeover, and its agenda. It's completely Jewish. And so we find that Oliver, who's on the board, eventually learns that Welch is just a front man and the whole thing is a big scam. I'm going to read that section again, or that sentence. I was not astonished, although was pained, by the discovery that Welch was merely the nominal head of the Birch business, so he's the public face of it, which he operated under the supervision of a committee of Jews, while Jews also controlled the flow through various bank accounts of the funds that were needed to supplement the money that was extracted from the society's members by artfully passionate exhortations to fight the communists. As soon as the investigation was complete, including the record of a scene meeting in a hotel at which Welch reported to his supervisor, I resigned from the Birch hoax on 30 July 1966, exactly 1 month after my birth, with a letter in which I let the little man know that his secret had been discovered. On the second of that month, I had kept an engagement to speak at the New England rally in Boston, where I gave the address, Conspiracy or Degeneracy, which was later published with documentary and supplemental notes by Power Products, a short-lived publishing firm in Nedrov, New York. After the speech, I was warmly congratulated by Welch, who was delighted that it had been generously applauded by an audience of more than 2,000, from whom he might recruit more members. He had not yet been informed by his supervisors that they disapproved. They did give him something of a dressing down, and when I resigned, he had the idea of pretending that he had been horrified by a speech that contained racial overtones, such as well-trained Aryans must always eschew. So that Birch was always just anti-communist, but never naming the Jew and never talking about race. Anti-communist is a political matter. So coming at it from a constitutional or a civic nationalist point of view. Paper isn't what matters, not blood. And he had the effrontery, which he later mitigated by claiming he had not received my letter. He had the effrontery, I say, to fly to Urbana, again in Illinois, accompanied by his lawyer and a former director of the Federal Reserve, on the assumption that a poor professor could easily be bribed to sign a substitute letter of resignation, which he had thoughtfully written out for me, together with the article in the Birch Bulletin in which he was going to announce his surprise at receiving the letter he had written for me. So complete dishonesty up and down. And remember, in the protocols of the learned elders of Zion, they say that the bribery is the first thing they use because it works on most goyim. Goyim, as it's actually pronounced. But I, frankly, maybe childishly, prefer to say goyim. It sounds better to my ear. Welch's sales talk was perhaps a little constricted because he had always to speak with my tape recorder operating on the table between us, and since I wished to say nothing that he could later misinterpret, I resisted the temptation to feign negotiations and thus ascertain what was the very highest price he was prepared to pay for my honor and self-respect. Footnote 2. Since that sickening afternoon, and you know, he spent over a decade, wasted his life on this fake, this fraud, I've been unable to think of the little shyster without revulsion and a feeling that I've been contaminated by association with him. I have tried to be not only scrupulously fair to him in the foregoing pages, but to give him the benefit of every possible doubt, and I believe I have succeeded, but it has cost me some effort. There were other resignations at approximately the same time. Dr. Draskovich, whose personal observation of the preliminaries of a Bolshevik takeover gave him expert knowledge, had investigated the Birch Society's field operations and come to the conclusion that the Society served only to waste in futile and nugatory activities, nugatory means amounting to nothing, the money, time, and energy of its patriotic members, so that it really served the purposes of the very forces that it professed to be fighting. He resigned with a public statement. The three directors of public relations, the Society's most important officers after Welch himself, all resigned, although he was able to induce them in various ways not to make their departures quite simultaneous. Each of us acted independently of the others, and I had not tried to influence anyone, but Welch characteristically saw a chance to claim that I had tried to, quote, undermine him and replace him as the head of his racket, and he went slinking about the country with a 57-page denunciation of me, most of it so libelous that he had to show it on an eyes-only basis to wealthy contributors whom he wanted to continue milking. By that time, he could have done nothing that would have augmented my contempt and loathing, and perhaps I should have felt flattered by the 57 pages. A man who joined the council long after I left and has recently resigned tells me that he was accorded only 17 pages of paranoid denunciation. After that last nauseating conference, I issued to the press an announcement that was widely reproduced. : His announcement. Professor Revelo P. Oliver, one of the founding members of the John Birch Society, issues the following statement. colon, quote, I have resigned from the council of the John Birch Society and from the society itself because I can no longer in conscience remain a member. I have also resigned as associate editor of American Opinion, and I will no longer contribute to that magazine. I was one of the 11 men who met with Mr. Robert Welch in Indianapolis on December 9, 1958, when the society was formed. The Mr. Welch who founded the society was a man in whom I had great confidence. Since then, however, changes which have taken place internally in the organization and in its policies leave me no alternative but to dissociate myself from it. Close quote. I felt a moral obligation to persons whom I might have influenced to join the Birch operation, and I thought that my statement, and especially the phrase, in conscience, would suffice to warn them that something was putrescent in Belmont. To the men who had been my associates on the council, I sent a letter of which the substance is the following, colon. The compelling reasons for my resignation were stated in my letter to Mr. Welch. I enclose a copy of the statement which I am making to the press. You will note that it is couched in the mildest possible terms and eschews mention of the real issues. I am resolved not to elaborate on that statement or make public my letter of resignation to Mr. Welch unless he forces me to do so by grossly misrepresenting its contents or publicly making defamatory charges against me. I urge each of you personally to investigate very thoroughly the present situation of the society and the extent to which its leader does, in fact, determine its policies. Hint, hint, hint. But Welch ain't the guy running the show. I hope that the society can be salvaged, but that is your responsibility. Two men telephoned me to say that they had already intended to fade out without publicity, thus avoiding the nastiness of an open break with the Welcher, for, footnote. How the others reacted then or at the following meeting of the council, I do not know, nor was I interested in finding out. I felt that I had given them, too, sufficient warning while sparing them possible embarrassment. Section 2. I have paid almost no attention to the Birch business since I resigned. I am somewhat astonished that Welch's superiors still think it worth the expense of supporting it, even though it does provide a playground on which innocent but perturbed Americans can run off their energies in harmless patriotic games. Friends still send me copies of some of the more remarkable verbiage that spurts from Belmont, and I note that Welch, perhaps, on instructions, no longer has much to say about the communist conspiracy, and, after flirting with the notion of reactivating Weishaupt's diabolic Illuminati, seems to have settled on the conveniently nameless and raceless insiders, capital I in quotes, as the architects of all evil, inspired by an unexplained malevolence. The principal purpose, aside from keeping the members in a revenue-producing excitement, is to make certain that their chaste minds are insulated against a wicked temptation not to love their enemies. The pronouncements from Belmont are of some slight interest, since one may be sure that the B'nai Birch are told, B'nai Birch, a good insult, are told only what has been approved by the B'nai Brith. In addition to the bulletin, often called the Welch Belch by board members, the Society still publishes American Opinion and the Review of the News, for which very competent journalists are hired to write under Jewish supervision, and both periodicals contain some authentic information that is not found in the New York Times, since they are censored for distribution to a different audience. I should have intoned that, since they are censored for distribution to a different audience, so they control what they're putting out, but it's always information that's shaded to serve Jews. A considerable misdirection of the members' thinking is thus produced, but even as an impediment to the American cause, the Birch hoax is virtually negligible. As Mr. Thomas J. Davis, the former director of public relations of the Birch Society, told the Wall Street Journal in 1967, I do not know of anything that would make the John Birch Society rise to a position of importance. So it's something that might have mattered, or might have mattered if it had been honest. It had some good men, but it really didn't mean much after 1970, let's say, to be generous. Although it was probably a little before that. It is true that today, 14 years later, the salesman, thanks to a well-written house organs, can still sell memberships to earnest people who are worried and don't know what to do about it. But in practical terms, the Birch Society has a political importance about equal to that of the Mennonite churches, which have a much larger membership of earnest and hard-working men and women in various communities, where they may be seen driving their covered buggies on the shoulders of highways while they resolutely hold to their faith and avert their eyes from all the works of the devil. That's quite true where I am. I've discussed Welch's promotion in these pages only because the record requires some explanation of my mistaken association with it. And the society that was founded in 1958 has some historical significance as comparable to Colonel Hadley's, Paul Revere's, and Major Pease's International Legion Against Communism, which also had a quite considerable potential at one time, although they failed for different reasons. And those are groups from earlier in the 20th century. After my resignation, many individuals urged me to expose the Welcher, but almost all of them had already perceived that the society had become a Jewish auxiliary, primarily used to keep the Goyim confused and docile and to frustrate patriotic movements that had any potentiality of effectiveness. A retired justice somewhat whimsically suggested the formulation of a John Birch Alumni Association, which could have a membership much more numerous than the undergrads who were still paying dues to Belmont. A number of men and women urged me to take the lead in establishing an organization that would really have the purposes that Welch professed. I refused to attempt what I was certain was impossible because, as I have explained earlier, there could be no second chance. The Birch Society was essentially an effort by Aryans of the middle class. Footnote 5. My pleasantest memories connected with it are of my gracious hosts, the members of local chapters in various cities throughout the nation who sponsored my lectures on its behalf. The men and women whom I thus met were the finest type of Americans, and I enjoyed the afternoons and evenings I spent in their company, but they were all, so far as I could tell, members of our race. Footnote 6. But almost without exception, those intelligent and amiable men and women had failed to draw the obvious deduction from the fact, failed to regard the racial bond that was the one thing they all had in common, for the managers of the Birch business had actually endorsed the poisonous propaganda that teaches Aryans that they are the one race that has no right to respect itself or even be conscious of its identity, and that they must forever cringe before their unappeasable, and there must be a word missing, opponents, let's say. Membership in the middle class, however, always implied a certain measure of economic independence, and the loss of that independence dissolved the middle class as a significant social stratum. The scheme of the organization of the Birch Society called for the chapters that were to meet in informal rotation in the homes of the members. That presupposed fairly spacious homes, incomes adequate to maintain them, hostesses who had some leisure for social activities and could obtain, at least occasionally, some domestic help, and, usually, men who had secretaries whose services they could divert from time to time. So long as the members were to be of the class that supplies community leaders and were to be the organizers of local fronts, that scheme of organization was unexceptionable and indeed requisite, and such prestige as the society ever had depended on the rule. The Birch Society always travels first class. When the Birch business tried to become in itself a popular movement, the chapter organization made it almost impossible to enlist any substantial support from the working class, quote unquote. So again, this is aimed at the upper middle class, or he's calling it maybe just the middle class, but people with some degree of money, and exactly the opposite of the type that Hitler aimed at, the working classes, workmen. A member who received hospitality he could not return was necessarily embarrassed, and segregation of members into chapters on the basis of income merely accentuated economic differences. And remember, our society has gotten more and more credential-driven, more and more danger from doxing, so all these tend to produce a more scared, less independent middle class than in his day. And that's part of what he means by he couldn't lead something himself, because the opportunity had passed, the time had changed, the river flowed, and it's now different circumstances. The birch salesmen soon began to vend their gospel to anyone who could be induced to pay the comparatively low dues. Indeed, they had to meet their implied sales quotas. The increasingly proletarian structure of American society did not alleviate the inherent difficulties, for there remains the divergence of interest between management and labor, and, as in all societies infested by Jews, there is a reciprocal hostility that is always latent and is evoked by talk about free enterprise and the other socioeconomic principles that were traditionally esteemed as virtues by the middle class. The only conceivable basis for a political movement that could transcend differences in income and manners is, of course, the biological unity of race. And that, of course, is precisely what the Birch hoax is now used to prevent. Enemies, both sophisticated and savage, while toiling to subsidize them. So it's denying people the knowledge they need to understand that only race can provide a basis for fighting the enemies, the actual enemies, not just some abstraction that the Birch are against. Many of those estimable persons would have been shocked by a suggestion that they had a right to consider first their own welfare and that of their children, for that would have been selfish, and even skeptics have been imbued with the hoary Christian hokum that we must love those who hate us. There was, therefore, no feasible course of action in 1966, when I knew that those well-meaning Aryans had been betrayed, and I felt certain that their cause had been irretrievably lost, although I tried to hope that my estimate was somehow wrong. Section 3. The American middle class has now been liquidated, except for, and God, he's saying that in the 60s, for Christ's sakes, except for a few remnants that are found here and there and are tolerated because they have no vestige of political power and will soon disappear anyway. Middle class can be based only on property, on the secure possession of real property, of which a man can be divested only by his own folly. A middle class cannot be formed of comparatively well-paid proletarians who may have a theoretical equity in a $150,000 house they are buying on a 35-year mortgage, and in a $15,000 automobile for which they will not have paid before they trade it in, on a more expensive and defective vehicle. Nor can it be formed of proletarians whose wives have to work, whether as executives or charwomen, to make ends meet. With the exception of relics who live on investments that have not yet been entirely confiscated by taxation, the economic revolution is as complete in the United States as in the Soviet Union, or in Soviet Russia. There are only proletarians, some of whom are hired to manage the rest. There are only proletarians, some of whom are hired to manage the rest. Managerial employees get more pay and ulcers than janitors and coal miners, but they are equally dependent on their wages and even more dependent on the favor of the employees above them. The nearest approximation to a middle class, both here and in Russia, is the bureaucracy, and it is their vested interest that the Birchers imagine they can destroy. The poor Birchers go on playing their patriotic games on their well-fenced playground. They pay their dues and buy books and pamphlets from Belmont to distribute to persons who may read the printed paper before discarding it. They continue, now and then, to coax a few friends to hear an approved speaker who, if not a Jew himself, at least knows who his bosses are, and they all listen excitedly as he tells them how very bad everything is, from Washington to Timbuktu, without ever mentioning any of the nasty facts of race and genetics, about which nice boys and girls should never think. Their little band is going to save the world politely and decorously by buying more books and pamphlets from Belmont and by practicing what Welch calls morality, an idle sentimentality compounded from the old hokum about all mankind and the inflated fustian of Emerson's transcendental rhetoric, seasoned, of course, with the famous upward reach, which employees in Belmont, who know what the business is about, privately call the upward wretch. So far as one can understand the mystique of the Birch Boys, they imagine they are going to save the world by talking about what they are sold as neat packages of truth, and since they could never think of being unkind to anyone, it would certainly swoon at the mere mention of violence. They must suppose that the wonder will be wrought by votes at some election. It appears, therefore, that they never take pencil and paper and compute the number of persons who are eligible to vote, noting how many are their hereditary enemies and how many are in one way or another directly on the federal payroll, how many more are employed by local governments, all of which are now subsidiaries supported by revenue sharing, and how many more depend on employers who depend on the favor or at least toleration of the great engine of corruption in Washington. Then they can compute the pitiable number of persons who would or could vote for less government, etc., even if by some miracle they had a chance to do so. Even more remarkable is the odd fact that Welch's congregation seems never to reflect that the Birch business has been running for 20 years, has accomplished nothing whatsoever except sop up the money and energy of well-meaning American Aryans, and now, after 20 years, has a membership that, on the most optimistic estimate, is but half of what it had at its peak 16 years ago. Does no member reflect that even if the Birch line is the quote-unquote truth, it is obviously ineffectual? That it never did and never will attract even a modicum of politically significant support? And that by its very nature it can never generate the kind of enthusiasm that is willing to fight rather than to talk. The B'nai Birch, to be sure, may bask in the approval of their amused and contemptuous Jewish supervisors, and they may feel some satisfaction that they keep their mind so pure and moral that they hate the wicked racists who believe, rightly or wrongly, that our race is fit to live, and who have the one cause that might conceivably generate sufficient political power to preserve us from the ignominious end of cowards fit only for slavery and a squalid death. But even in this respect, the Birch hoax, now so insignificant that the prostitutes of the press forget to say unkind things about it now and then to make the members feel important, has become so impotent that it will not measurably affect our fate, whatever that is to be. So long as it was honest, if it ever was, the Birch Society represented the last hope of American conservatism, of the effort to restore the values and the freedom of the way of life of our Aryan forefathers on this continent, to regain what they lost when they thoughtlessly permitted their country to be invaded, their government to be captured, and their society to be systematically debauched and polluted by whining aliens. The American tradition was a fair and indeed noble one, and it still has the power to awaken nostalgia for a world that no man living has himself experienced, and he's saying this in the 60s. But for practical purposes, it now only has a literary and historical significance. To be sure, there are, outside the inconsequential Birch playpens, earnest men and women who still hope to restore the decent society and strictly limited government of that tradition, and their loyalty to what has ineluctably passed away entitles them to respect, just as we respect the British Jacobites who remain loyal to the Stuarts and nourished hopes for a century after Culloden, and as we respect the earnest men and women in France who, as late as 1940, remain loyal to the Bourbons and dreamed of restoring them to their throne. But such nostalgic aspirations for the past are mere romanticism. They are dangerously antiquarian illusions today, when the only really fundamental question is whether our race still has the will to live, or is so biologically degenerate that it will choose extinction, to be absorbed in a pullulent and pestilential mass of mindless mongrels, while the triumphant Jews keep their holy race pure and predatory. American conservatism is finished, and its remaining adherents are, whether they know it or not, merely ghosts, wandering, mazed in the daylight. And it is at this point that the present volume of selections from what I wrote on behalf of a lost cause fittingly ends. Page 430, that is. And then just a few notes. But he ends, conservatism is dead, and it's romantic to think otherwise, and you have to look to race and biology. Notes. 1. Some unimportant reviews, which were already in type, appeared in later issues. 2. Assuming that Welch really believes that there is any consideration which would prevent a man from doing anything for a few thousand fast bucks, he obviously expected me to sign a letter in which, after crawling to the foot of the throne in contrition for having embarrassed the Messiah by saying something to which Jews objected, I would say, "Of course I want to remain as a member of the society itself, and to support all of its measures with which I agree for exposing and routing the communist conspiracy. Also, I wish to write for American Opinion, where you can always simply fail to publish any contribution of mine which is contrary to its basic policies, or which cannot be edited to fit your needs without committing mayhem on the article. Further, to show that this action is taken on an entirely friendly basis, let's make my resignation from the Council effective immediately after the September Council meeting, and I promise not to make any world-shaking speeches in the meantime." Close quote. And in the article in which he was to announce his surprise at receiving the letter, his resignation letter, the slimy creature told his dupes, "We have accepted Dr. Oliver's resignation from the Council of the Society," from the Council, all caps, "of the Society," not necessarily the Society itself, being the distinction, "with a considerable and natural reluctance. But it is his own wish that we avoid the misinterpretation of the Society's position, such as arose following his speech at the New England rally. We have, therefore, made his resignation effective on September 15, as Dr. Oliver requested." Close quote. In the rest of that tissue of lies, after protesting that it is no more possible for us actually to be anti-Semitic, for instance, than it is for water to turn to vinegar, the sleazy little atheist had no hesitation about saying that, quote, "The philosophy and purpose of the society are built on the unshakable belief that man has been endowed by a divine creator with an upward reach which is eternally at work," close quote, thus blotting out the facts of both biology and human history. Anything to catch conies. Those are rabbits. So he's an atheist pretending to believe in a divinity, divine creator, just to catch members. 3, i.e., excluding the three men who attended but were wise enough not to become involved in Welch's scheme. 4, one told me that a little earlier Welch had informed him, quote, "in strict confidence," that three members of the council were covert communist agents, oddly enough not including either Dr. Draskovich or myself among the persons he named. Such statements should be regarded as evidence of technique, not paranoia. He used to tell me, in strict confidence, quote unquote, before a meeting which members of the council were, quote, "unreliable because their religious superstitions, their greed, the precarious financial position of their corporations, or their family connections made them subject to, quote, influence." I am ashamed to admit that for years I believed him, and thereafter attributed such statements to pique at the small amounts each contributed. For the greater part of the time, I was the only member of the council who was not relatively wealthy and could not be expected to underwrite a crusade to, quote, "save America." So I suppose most of them were businessmen or heads of corporations, whereas he was a professor. 3 more. 5, the Birch Society was necessarily a middle-class movement, and its members represented in both intelligence and character the best of their declining class. British readers should remember that the American middle class differed widely from the British middle class in its social ambiance and ethos. The United States never had a peerage, and its landed gentry were effectively liquidated as a class by the northern states in their jihad against the southern states in 1861-65. The United States never had anything of consequence that was comparable to the public school tradition of England or to the concept of tradesmen as distinct from gentlemen. After the Puritans' holy war against the South and their ruthless oppression of the vanquished, social classes in the United States became, for all purposes, merely levels of income. 6. The only Jew that I remember having encountered in such circles was an overseer employed by Belmont, and he, characteristically, had adroitly driven from the local chapter some of their most important members, including a distinguished and courageous physician, whom I met only because I somewhat impolitely insisted on it, and my host courteously arranged overnight an unofficial luncheon for that purpose. 7. If our contemporaries would read the better periodicals of the 1920s, they would discover that one of the most reprehended aspects of Bolshevism, that means hated, in Russia was that married women were compelled to seek employment, thus destroying the family as a unit. One can only smile cynically at the success of the polyphase propaganda that has convinced American women that it is fine to be wage earners, even if they fancy themselves socially above the peasantry and are not childless. footnotes, and then PDF has a picture of the suppressed issues of American opinion. Then there's Appendix 1, the political writings of Dr. Revelo Pialaver, 1936 to 1966. I am not going to read through all them, but just a little bit to show you what he wrote for. The political writings of Appendix 1, the political writings of Revelo Pialaver, 1936-66. Strictly scholarly or literary works are excluded. Speeches that were published in newspapers, ephemeral periodicals, or pamphlets have been omitted. Only the first publication of each item is shown, and reprints in other periodicals or as brochures have been ignored. The listing is strictly chronological. The titles of booklets are in italics. The titles of articles are enclosed in quotation marks and followed by a notation of the periodical, date of the issue, and the page numbers. When articles include a critical evaluation of important books, thus making separate reviews unnecessary, the books are listed below the article. Reviews are indicated by a compendious form of the author's name and the title, followed by notation of the periodical and the date of the issue. But page numbers are not given, since the item may easily be located in the review section of the issue cited. Reviews of publications of the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Un-American Activities and of the Senate Subcommittee on Internal Security are indicated by the title, often condensed, within quotation marks, followed by the notation House or Senate. Periodicals are designated by sigla, viz. And these are what he wrote for. AM, the American Mercury. Now that was Mencken's old magazine, and it was sold to someone else before Dr. Oliver wrote for it. AO, American Opinion, the organ of the John Birch Society. American Progress, organ of the National Committee for Economic Freedom. The Citizen, organ of the Citizens' Councils of America, the White Councils, Citizens' Councils, this type thing. GN, the Greater Nebraskan, organ of the Congress of Freedom. MA, Modern Age. NB, Nation's Business, and NR, National Review, William F. Buckley's just another liberal rag, as Wilmore Kendall called it before 1970, and then a chronological list of all of his publications. And that will leave us with only one more segment to go, which will cover his second appendix and any small matters after that. So thanks for being with me today. I'm Ben Alex, Alex Linder, reading to you from Revelo Oliver's America's Decline, The Education of a Conservative. And you can find it and everything we record at vnnforum.com as part of our Learning College of audiobooks and material you will never get in public schools, treating events in a way that they'll never be treated in any kind of public school where Jews set the agenda for the publishers. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again for the final segment of Revelo Oliver's America's Decline real soon.